This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The rumor mill is certainly thriving in the 21st century, fueled by the internet and social media. But roll the clock back, way back, to the 1600s, the 1700s. Even without the help of Facebook or Twitter, rumors spread very quickly in early America. These rumors may have been groundless, but they took root, and they impacted many important issues of the day and many important decisions, including whether or not to go to war. University of Michigan history and American culture professor Gregory Evans Dowd explores all of this in his new book, Groundless: Rumors, Legends, and Hoaxes on the American Frontier. Greg, so good to have you with us today on Stateside.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here, Cynthia.
Let's break this down so we're all on the same page. Differentiate for us between rumor, legend, and hoax.
All right, let's go backwards. A hoax is certainly deliberate. It has a deliberate origin. Somebody creates it, disseminates it, wants to shape events. A rumor can begin with a hoax. A rumor can have its origins in deliberate misinformation, which is what a hoax is. But rumors also often arise independent of an individual author. They sometimes arise in the collective imagination. They form as people are trying to figure out what's going on in ambiguous circumstances.
And often frightening circumstances.
Frightening really helps with the ambiguity and with the determination to create a rumor.
And probably the speed in which it spreads.
Exactly. So rumors can definitely begin with hoaxes, but they also, sometimes we really don't know where they begin. And that's their very nature. The very nature of a rumor is that we don't know its origin. So in my work, I do discuss a hoax that began with Benjamin Franklin, for instance. He deliberately obscured his authorship. He understood media as well as anybody else in his age. Mm-hmm. He deliberately obscured his authorship. He circulated this saying, oh, I don't really know where this came from.
And what was it that he was circulating?
Well, it was a rather horrific story about British officers rewarding Indians for bales of scalps taken on the frontier. So massive quantities of scalps packaged, sent to the British and being rewarded, the Indians being rewarded for mm-hmm. taking these. And this was completely came out of his rather thinning head. But he was smart enough to conceal his authorship as he circulated. So the point is that a rumor is of uncertain origin. That's why I titled mm-hmm. the work Groundless.
Groundless. And then legends.
So a legend is also groundless, like a rumor. A legend is generally passed on from generation to generation. It is it's historical in nature. It's usually a story about the past that's passed on from generation to generation. But like a rumor, it has uncertain origin. And the two phenomena, rumor and legend, overlap. You have rumors that also are passed on seemingly from generation to generation. They're always about something that's taking place now.
Interesting.
But they resemble very much similar stories or almost identical stories that were told in the past.
Can you give us an example of one that we might have heard of today that you could say, you know what, they were saying that back in the 1700s, 1800s?
Well, certainly rumors involving other religions are repeated over and over again. Probably some of the most enduring rumors in Western culture would be rumors that are anti-Semitic in nature. Mm. But one rumor that I deal with in the book that does circulate today, I think it has its origins in probably the 19th century, is the rumor about the smallpox blanket. And that's a rumor that's told certainly not only in among American Indians, but also among Anglo-Americans.
And this is the one where they say that that the tribes were deliberately given blankets
infected with smallpox. And it did happen once that we know of. I mean, it is documented.
So there's a little grain of truth.
There's a grain of truth. Mm-hmm. And that's the case with many rumors. In 1763, British officers did discuss and actually did pass out.
Early germ warfare.
Early germ warfare, indeed.
Wow. When I think about this, it seems very clear from your book, everybody was fueling this rumor mill back on in the early days.
It's human nature.
Absolutely. Native Americans had theirs. British soldiers had ones. Was it something about eyes being gouged out?
Exactly. Eye gouging was thought to be an American practice on the frontier, but this eye gouging, this particular eye gouging, took place in Concord, Massachusetts, which was not exactly the frontier at the Battle of Lexington and Concord.
But
in
it's, they all serve a purpose. Because you talk about what Ben Franklin, he circulates this. So it serves a purpose to coalesce you against.
Yeah,
fill in the blank.
It is could be a part of what's sometimes called othering or prejudice. In the case of the British at the time, they saw the Americans as savages and identified these Americans as being similar to Native Americans who they had also recently fought.
We saw that in World War II when civilians in Okinawa were told by the Japanese that the Americans were going to do awful things to them. And you saw those people jumping to their deaths over a cliff because of the fear of the rumor that had been circulated by the Japanese.
So, yes, these things are rife through history.
I'm talking with University of Michigan history and American culture professor Gregory Evans Dowd. His book is Groundless: Rumors, Legends, and Hoaxes on the American Frontier. Take us into this one very famous early American rumor. It happened in Michigan, and it was about Henry Schoolcraft.
Henry Schoolcraft one day was given a newspaper by a friend in Washington, D.C., and he read his own obituary. He read that he had been murdered at Sault Ste. Marie. He actually hadn't been to Sault Ste. Marie he hadn't been there since 1841. But the rumor had it that he had been murdered by what was termed a man who was termed a mixed blood. Actually, he was termed a half-breed, John Tanner. John Tanner, who had no Indian ancestry, John Tanner, who was a so-called white Indian, that is a boy captured at the age of 9, taken up into Michigan, who lived, was adopted by a woman whom he remembered quite generously, Netnokwa, and he spent his late childhood, teens, early adulthood, really until he was about 40 years old, among Ottawas and Ojibwas in northern Michigan and west of Lake Superior.
So he was identified as a supposed murderer.
He was identified as the murderer of, in the initial rumor, Henry Schoolcraft. That was soon corrected. Henry Schoolcraft was reading his own obituary, knew he hadn't been murdered. He was in Washington, D.C., but he surmised that there might be a nugget of truth in this rumor. And that nugget of truth turned out to be true. It was that his younger brother, James Schoolcraft, had been shot dead.
And what was the political climate? Did this serve some kind of purpose to stir things up?
Well, I think so. There really is very little evidence that John Tanner shot Henry Schoolcraft. John Tanner disappeared around the time of the murder. That might be some evidence. But John Tanner was a 66-year-old man. He had been disabled in a series of accidents. The shooting apparently took place in broad daylight. People claim to have heard the shot and seen the smoke. And yet this disabled 66-year-old man supposedly escaped with many young, skilled Ojibwas and Anglo-Americans in hot pursuit. It's rather difficult to believe.
And at the same time, there was quite a growing movement in Michigan to push the Ottawas and the Ojibwas out of the state.
There was.
Yes.
And Henry Schoolcraft had long been an advocate, oddly enough, and I say oddly enough because his wife was of Indian descent, but he had long been an advocate for Indian removal. He had frequently said, oddly enough again, that Indians and whites cannot live side by side. And so he was, he pushed removal. And I think that his belief in Tanner's guilt had, and his firm belief, even when other evidence surfaced that perhaps someone else had done it, his own brother-in-law thought someone else had done it, he was so convinced that Indians and whites could not live side by side that he saw in John Tanner a man who had been contaminated by long life among the Indians.
So proof positive. This is what I believe, and John Tanner proves it. Interesting. You use the phrase rumoring with a vengeance in your book. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was a turn of phrase meant to describe an Anglo-American sense that at the time, Native Americans were characterized, particularly in warfare, by vengeance, by revenge, that the main motive in war was revenge. Now, this is rather extraordinary if you actually think about it. People go to war for all kinds of reasons. Revenge might be a reason. but that it's the reason was extremely popular among Anglo-Americans at the time. And
let them off the hook
of
what was going on.
Well, exactly. But what's actually kind of peculiar about it is if you think about what Native Americans might have reason to be vengeful for when it comes to Anglo-America, dispossession,
throwing off
a considerable
lands.
Amount of violence.
Yes.
And these people in the 19th century did have a sense of that. They had a sense that they had been responsible for ill deeds against Native Americans. And so this was also part of the urge for removal. I mean, the sense that we really can't live side by side because these people have a grievance against us.
Interesting. University of Michigan History and American Culture Professor Gregory Evans Dowd, his book, Groundless Rumors, Legends, and Hoaxes on the American Frontier. Great talking with you. Thank you.
I am delighted. Thank you so much.